I'm sending you to California, Fort Spencer.
We have 4 missing soldiers, Captain, and no bodies. We need a supportable explanation.
Captain John Boyd is out to solve a mystery.
No one just ends up at Fort Spencer. We come for a reason.
Yours being?
Well, but he is about to discover.
We have a great sense of camaraderie here at Fort Spencer.
Something he never imagined.
Winged eagle.
It's an old Indian myth from the north.
Man eats the flesh of another. He absorbs the other man's strength.
Now, one man must choose.
We need others.
Between having dinner.
Not me.
And being dinner.
Good gracious.
That's so annoying.
A la Major Knox.
Guy Pearce.
I'm gonna kill him.
Robert Carlyle.
He was tough, but then a good soldier ought to be.
Jeffrey Jones.
I want to bring you into the fold.
What's wrong?
David Arquette.
There's no guilt. I gotta eat. But it's tough making friends.
Eat to live. Don't live.
That was really sticky.
He was licking me!
Ravenous.
Bon appetit.
And welcome to the Cult Cinema Circle podcast. My name is Jesse, and I'll be your host today. Now, on today's episode, we're going to head over to Fort Spencer and go be taken to this, like, really gross fort in the middle of, like, California. And you know what? We're going to meet a weird guy that came on our doorstep, and I don't know. We're just going to, like, vibe and chill in the middle of the, you know, Sierra Mountains or whatever. Regardless of all that, today, though, we're going to be covering a little movie from 1999 that is celebrating its 25-year anniversary this year called Ravenous. By doing this movie, though, I could not do this alone. So I have a nice, fun guest with me today. So you may have heard him, or if you've never heard him, you'll want to hear him on the Men Who Like Movies podcast, or lovingly Triple M Pod. Please welcome to my show, Clayton Jones the Second. Hey, Clayton, how are you today?
I'm doing wonderful. I'm so glad you had this on your list.
Yes.
I think this movie is very underseen, so queer, and I jumped at the opportunity. So thank you.
Of course. Yeah. And I think I became familiar with you. God, I don't even remember. But like, I think we just started following each other because we're both little indie pods, you know, and full of gay people and all that good stuff. Yeah. So I mean, like, I'm sure we just kind of followed each other. But, you know, I've only been able to listen so much to I think I was listening to the Saved episode because I love Saved.
Saved is so fun.
Oh, it's so good. It was Sheree Bohannon from Nightmare on Fear Street and all her podcasts she has. But yeah, it's just like, but yeah, I think this will be the beginning of a wonderful partnership, friendship, because I just like other gays who like movies too. So we've got some things in the works, y'all. Exactly. But yeah, hopefully we won't have any technical difficulties. Before we started recording, my headphones weren't fucking working, which was annoying. But you know what? It'll be all good. It's President's Day. I can do anything through Christ. Okay. It's not actually President's Day, but it's the weekend before, so it's fine. But yeah, Clayton, tell me a little bit though, because this movie, I had never seen it until very recently. So I think I became familiar with it when Dead Meat, the channel on YouTube, they did a podcast on it, which was a really good podcast, by the way. But I became familiar with it through that, and then it was actually on Criterion Channel for 90s horror. They had a collection with it and it was on there. So that's when I actually physically watched it for the first time. And I personally fell for it. I fell in love. But tell me a little bit about your history with this. Like, how did this movie come into your life? And what is it about it that, you know, gets you interested and wanted to talk about it with another fellow gay?
Oh, man. I saw this, I think, in college. I don't remember how I came across it, but it was just one of those movies. I don't know if I just like came across like a VHS sale or like a DVD sale, or just like it wasn't like on streaming or something at that point. And I was like, oh, man, this is really, really good. Why does nobody ever talk about this? And obviously, you know, 1999, the greatest year of cinema. You can get lost in the shuffle, I guess, but I thought it was great. I had a crush on Guy Pearce ever since The Count of Monte Cristo as a kid. And I was just like, this is super gay. It's just really good. And it's not something I watch all the time. Like, I was looking on Letterboxd, the last time I watched this was like 2020 or 2021. And I'm always like, man, I should watch this more every time I see it. I'm just like, this is really good. Why don't I throw this on more often? But yeah. Wanted to talk about it.
I wanted to, and this is not to be mean to you or anything. I wanted to make the Heather's joke of just like, because you're an idiot. but that's mean, but you would have gotten it because Heather's.
I would have gotten it and I would have loved it.
And I did say it. So. Always, no matter what. Don't worry. I have the musical loaded up on Roku and I'm going to watch it. I'm going to see if it's good.
Tell me if it's good. I'm scared.
I'll let you know. I'll let you know, because I think it's like a pro shot of it, so it's on the stage or whatever. So I hope it's good. I'm gonna give it
a chance. Like, I've seen several casts. I have the ones I like, and I don't know how I feel about this production. But
well, baby, it's free on Roku, so I'm gonna tell you what it's about. Okay, I'm gonna tell you. Yeah, we'll do that.
But literally, like, message me the second you finish it and be like, is this worth watching? Because I love me some Heathers. Even when Riverdale did it.
Oh, God, yeah. But anyway, I also want to see the Mean Girls musical, but I'm going to wait for that to stream, though. I think I'm going to wait for that.
I liked it.
Yeah, I love that. But yeah, so, but with all this being said, you know, we're going to go into a little bit about, you know, the figures of this film, a little bit about the production history, because it's got a little bit of a spicy history. And we're also just going to talk about the plot, characters, some of the themes that are in this movie, all that good stuff, you know what I mean? So, this movie in particular, Ravenous, was released March 19th of 1999. So yesterday, from when you're hearing this, it'll be celebrating 25 years since it's been released. So yay, Ravenous. It was released by 20th Century Fox, which is why you can watch this on Disney Plus in the UK, which is super fun to me. Or Canada, whichever one, I think. But yeah, super, super cute. I don't know why it's not on, like, fucking Hulu or something like all the time, but whatever, you know. But it makes the rounds here and there, which is always nice. It's 100 minutes, so not too long. I don't think it overstays its welcome. Maybe it could have been cut down just a tiny bit, but it's not anything that's egregious.
Okay, every single movie now is like 2 hours 20 minutes at the shortest. So looking at this runtime, like, man, this is a breeze.
Right, exactly, man, exactly. I mean, that Heather's musical is like 2 hours and 15 minutes. I'm just like, bitch, it's a musical, okay? Fine. And also, hey, like,
they cut a lot of songs and it still was right, mostly good choices.
That's good. Yeah, no, and also The Color Purple's on Max right now, and I've seen the original, but like, do you want to watch the musical? It's like 2 hours and 20 minutes. I'm just like, I'll make it through.
So The Color Purple, I have only seen the film once. I've never read the book. And I didn't love it. I generally like really depressing stuff, but I'm like, man, this is just a bummer. And so when it was made into a musical and everybody loved it, and I'm like, okay, I just don't want to see this story told through song. And then it came out and I'm like, I'm usually there for any musical, and we're really feasting right now. There's 3 movies in the movie theater right now you go see that are musicals. That's great. And I just wasn't going to see it. And then she got nominated for an Oscar, and I tried to watch all of the performances so I can be properly annoyed the day of awards. And so I'm like, God damn it, I have to watch it. And I was like, I don't want to go see it in the theater. That's just a long time to sit there for a movie like that. I want to watch it at home. And I'm like, I don't want to pay $20 for it. And I saw that HBO was getting it, and I've been checking, and it's like, wasn't there. So thank you for telling me that it is now available on HBO.
Yes, it's because YouTube told me it was. And I was like, fuck yeah, put it on the list.
Thanks. doing the Lord's
work. Of course. Of course. Always. Hail Satan. But anyway, so and it was a $12 million budget. Now we're going to get into the figures of this movie. So it was at number 18. It's opening weekend with about $1,040,727. Overall, and it never did international. So really, it only ever made, I think I've heard my figures here say 2 million. I think it might have made like 6 million at the most, maybe. But guess what? That's really bad when it comes to a movie, especially if it's, it was a theatrical release. So, that's
so bad. But it's, I mean, really again, 1999, it was a crowded theater. Like, it was time.
Yeah, no, yeah, totally. It's really unfortunate. At least that's what Box Office Mojo told me. And I tend to believe them for the most part. Yeah, no, it, even if it wasn't 2 million, it might have been a little bit more. I was like, that's bad. Like, so needless to say, that's what kind of puts it into the cult of it all, because it did not do well financially, period. Especially for Fox, you know, at this time. But yeah, and then in terms of reviews, it kind of, it's a little bit, so we have like 52% of Rotten Tomatoes from critics who, you know, are critics, quote unquote. But then it does have a 78% on audience. So I think that some audiences have kind of embraced this more as this kind of weird Western horror kind of thing, I guess, which is cool. And then it sits at a 3.6 out of 5 on Letterboxd. Do you have any thoughts on any of that?
The critic thing kind of surprises me a little bit, honestly. But the audience, I'm pleasantly surprised. And on Letterboxd, that sounds about right for Letterboxd. Mm. Like, I have it as a 4 on Letterboxd, so it's
fine. Yeah. Same here. Same here. I would say it was a 4 for me because I do like, you know, we'll get all into that. Yeah. But yeah. So yeah, that's like the critical response of it. I'm sure we can also, we'll pull from what some of the critics might have said, like specifically, but we'll talk about that a little later.
I did pull a quote from Ebert, I will say, that I thought was very funny.
What was it?
He gave it 3 stars out of 4, incidentally, and said, he was talking about the director, and said, her shots of me are all cheerfully off-putting. And I thought that was a really, really funny sentence.
I love that. I mean, it is, but, you know, there you go. Yeah. So I love that. But yeah, so that's a little bit about like the critical and also just like the financials behind the movie as well. So when we talk about the production crew and the cast of this movie, so this is a director, Antonia Bird, really was only known for this movie in terms of like a feature film. She had done some other films before too, but I think they were very specific to the UK. And I think she had also done TV as well. And theater as well.
She was a British director, I believe.
Yes, yes. And unfortunately passed in 2013, which sucks. But also directed by a woman. But this, yeah, you know, that's super cool.
Directed yeah. by a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Coming in at the last minute and doing a great job, I might add.
I think she did too. And we'll get into that too. It's fucking crazy. The writer of this is Ted Griffin. So he wrote this based off of a little bit of The Donner Party, which we could talk a tiny bit about. And then also Alfred Packer, I guess, as well. So a little bit of an amalgamation of all that. I think more so Donner Party was like the setting. And then Alfred Packer is more of Calhoun's character, if anything, which is cool. Ted Griffin, he went on to write Ocean's 11. And also rumor has it, that movie, I think, with Jennifer Aniston, which I don't know what it's about. But
okay. Yeah, I didn't bother watching it. It looked bad. Fine.
Probably bad. Yeah. But yeah, so he's the writer. Nice. Yeah, I don't care about being nice on the show all the time. Depends, but who does? And then a really interesting thing too is the composers of this movie, one of whom is Michael Nyman, who he had done The Piano, and I think he did Gattaca as well, which is cool. But also you have Damon Albarn from Gorillaz and also Blur from the 90s and 2000s, who is also composer of this movie too, which is super cool.
The 90s. What a time.
Yes, absolutely. And the music is such a weird part of this movie too. it is because there's like these, so Nyman, I think, did more of the orchestral stuff, whereas I think Damon did a little bit more of some of the, you know, kind of stuff that's in here.
It's, I don't know really how fun. Many times in my notes I was just like, what is this score? It's so weird, but I love it.
No, seriously. And that's not the only time I think that criticism's been there, because it's fucking weird. This whole movie is weird, and we'll talk about that. But yeah, we also have to talk about the icon that is the cinematographer of this movie, Anthony B. Richmond, who is also a Brit. A lot of Brits in here because, you know, fucking a director's Brit, so makes sense. So I think she brought in a couple people that she already knew from the scene. But Anthony B. Richmond, he has done so many movies. I mean, goddamn, he is the guy who did Legally Blonde, Candyman, The Sweetest Thing, Tales from the Hood, Cherry Falls, and that's not even like including a lot of other shit he did. So yeah, he's kind of an icon to me, at least. Which, you know, just with steady working, I guess.
I have never seen Cherry Falls.
It's fun. I would say it was on Shudder for a minute. It doesn't really gonna stream anywhere else. I'd love to do it on the show, but and I probably will. I think if anything, try to find a cheap copy of it, like either on Blu-ray or DVD. You could probably find a Blu-ray cheap. Yeah, it's fucking wild.
I'm quite sure I would love it. It's just sometimes watching Brittany Murphy just makes me sad.
Oh, same here, because I also love her a lot. But yeah, it's and what's interesting about that is that also had a really bad release history, because Clayton, I don't know if you know this, and you might learn about it if you listen to my episode that I'm gonna do on it, I guess, but I'll tell you here right now. So Cherry Falls was, it cost $15 million to make. Okay. And it was supposed to be a theatrical release, kind of in the wave of the post slasher, scream slasher stuff and all that kind of shit. And then guess what? It never came out in theaters in the US. It only ever did theaters, I think, in Canada and the UK. And it came out on the beloved USA Network. That's literally where it premiered in the US, which is crazy. Which
I did not know that. I would have thought, yes. Because I feel like everyone I know has seen it and loves it. Mm-hmm. Like, I literally feel like I'm the only person that has never seen Cherry Falls.
It's because it's hard to find. It was on Shudder for like a month. And they had even a whole little watch thing where they were like people who really liked the movie. And they had like Michael Kennedy, I think, like he introduced it or something or whatever. And I remember watching it then. But it's because it's hard to find, kind of. But there is release of it. There's a Blu-ray release they did. I think Scream Factory did that. But it kind of has the distinction of being one of, if not the most expensive TV movie made, because that's what it was.
Yeah, that's crazy. I had no idea. I thought it was like a huge hit in theaters.
Nope, it was. And the story itself is not the worst or anything. The release of it got fucked because, yeah, it never came out theatrically in the US, and it only ever came on the US network like that. Like, it premiered there, and it was lost really for a long time. It was kind of like, it's not the same thing, but because the movie I'm going to reference is not something that would have come out in theaters, but All About Evil kind of did that. Have you ever seen that movie? Mm-hmm. It's the Peaches Christ movie that she directed and made with Thomas Dekker and Natasha Lyonne.
Oh, yeah.
It's on Shudder right now.
I don't know if you're following Thomas Dekker on Instagram. Okay. But
I don't know if I am following him, but what's he doing? Is he doing something bad or good?
Oh, I would recommend following Thomas Dekker on Instagram, and I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. I think I either do or I've seen him do stuff. And listen, I've been on the Movies Manuscript. He was on there too. Hey, Thomas. And you know what, too? His husband's name is Jesse, and he's Canadian. So I love that for him.
That's wonderful.
That's beautiful. Also, did you know that have you ever seen Trick or Treat from 2007?
Yes.
Did you know that his husband is actually the guy in the beginning who's like creepily waiting across the street from where Leslie Bibb is?
Really?
That's him. That's Jesse Haddock. So like literally that guy who's like, it's the whole thing of like, oh, he's just a guy in a mask or whatever.
Yeah.
That boy, like, who's a young guy, that's Jesse Haddock, who's Canadian and is now Tom Secker's husband. So
what a journey for him.
I know, right? But anyway, back to All About Evil. But All About Evil released, like, it released and then got lost for a long time until Shudder and also Severin Films, sorry, not Vinegar Syndrome. They released a Blu-ray copy of it, which I own. And I think with Cherry Falls, I promise this is about Ravenous, but whatever, we go on tangents here. But Cherry Falls pretty much had the same thing happen where like it was lost for a long time. Really, the only thing you can do is get a Blu-ray copy of it. But I recommend it, even with, you know, you can have your shine to Brittany Murphy, baby. It's fine. But, you know, but it's a fun little thing. And it's not the worst out there, to be honest. You know, it is what it is.
I'm sure I would love it. I'm right up my alley.
Absolutely. And then Neil Farrell is the editor of this movie. He did Hamlet from 1996. So the Kenneth Branagh one. And he also did a movie called Cockneys versus Zombies, which just sounds fun.
Yes. Cockneys versus Zombies. Which was the last film of Honor Blackman, Pussy Galore herself, before she died.
Oh, really? Yes. is that James Bond reference, right?
Yes. And she also, I don't know if you're a Bridget Jones fan. She's, how familiar are you with Bridget Jones?
I know Renee Zellweger's in it.
Oh, okay. Never mind. She's in this like scene. It's really funny. and it was a long time before I was like, oh my God, that's Pussy Galore from James Bond. Yeah. Anyway.
Love that. I'm not a James Bond kind of girl personally. The only thing I know is that Sean Connery is in it, and they talk about that in Train Spotting, which we'll get to in a minute. But but also in Spice World, when they're doing the photo montage, one of the things that Victoria, when they're doing the little photo montage and she like has the knife and like she's in a bikini or whatever, that's a James Bond reference. That's all I know. So I'm literally okay. I don't even know what that character referencing is, but
I just never have. I don't know why, but yeah. Otherwise, I would absolutely be able to tell you that. I know it's really bad. I've also never seen Crossroads.
I have not either, and I will tell you this right now. Don't worry, we're going to do an episode on it. My sister and me are going to do it because we loved the Spice Girls. I'm gonna tell you what, though, Clayton. I'm gonna tell you something. I said this on one of my episodes before. You could just go on YouTube and just like watch like some of the movie clips of Spice World probably. And guess what? You've watched the movie. Like, that's it. Like, it's not, there's not a gigantic story there. There's whatever. It's all about the vibes, baby. It's all about the gay vibes on it. Like, that's all it is.
I mean, that's what they did best.
True. Very true. Speaking of gay vibes, we got Guy Pearce in this movie. Okay. He plays, God, what is his name? Boyd? Is he Boyd?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Military title, Boyd.
Some guy, Boyd, exactly. So Guy Pearce, he was in like Memento. He was in, I know him as Felicia from The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, putting some respect on that name. God, she's so fucking good in that movie. Like, and then like The King's Speech, and wasn't he in a James Bond movie, or did I Photoshop him into that, to be honest? I don't know, maybe.
I don't think so. He was in Iron Man. He was in,
oh yeah,
Prometheus. I don't remember him being in a James Bond movie. He would fit right in though.
Yeah, he would. He really would. Exactly. Yeah. Very pretty face, like all that kind of stuff. Exactly. Exactly. And then we have Robert Carlyle. For me, he's in 28 weeks later. He's in the sequel to 28 Days Later, but I will always know him as Begbie from Train Spotting, which you did share with me that you have not seen Train Spotting.
I know, and it looks so good. I just haven't ever watched it. I don't have a reason why. It's just one of those things that has never been at the number one of my things I needed to watch, and it just hasn't happened.
Yeah. And you also, because we were also talking yesterday, like we were messaging, and you at least like the boy from Slumdog Millionaire. I don't know if you like the movie, but that's also from Danny Boyle, so it's like,
I think Danny Boyle's great. I love Ewan McGregor. Love Robert Carlyle. There's literally no reason I just haven't pulled the trigger. It just hasn't ever been that number one. This is the vibe I'm feeling, right?
That's fair. I think I explained it as if Requiem for a Dream was more fun, but it's not as sad, kind of. So, like, it's sad, but like also, like, I don't know. It's good. I like it.
We covered Requiem for a Dream last year, and I was the one that had picked it, and Sean was just like, ugh. And we kept having to like move it around. I don't remember. There was like something, our guest had like a family issue or something. So we like moved it around a couple times. I ended up watching Requiem for a Dream 3 times in a week. And I was just,
oh no.
Like, by the time we recorded it and everything, I got through it. And I was just like, I never want to think about Requiem for a Dream again in my entire life.
Are you okay? Do you need like some ice cream or something? Like,
Oh, it's fine. I'm severely depressed. I handled it quite well. But okay, I was just great. Like, oh my God, my brain just was dead. I don't recommend.
No, I understand that. Dream
3 times in a week's time span.
I understand that. I could not do that.
5-star film. Not for 3 times in a week, though.
God, I don't like that movie that much, to be honest. Give me Train Spotting all day. Anyway, so that is Robert Carlyle, though. He plays Calhoun with a silent Q in his name, which I just think is fun. So
yes, I watched it with subtitles today for the first time, and I was like, huh, okay.
Yeah. Isn't that weird?
Q in there. Wouldn't have thought.
I know, right?
Robert Carlyle, do you think he's hot?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, so I've always heard about people talking about him being hot when I was younger, when I think like Once Upon a Time was starting or something. And mm-hmm. I knew him mainly as a kid from The World Is Not Enough. Also, it came out in 1999, in which he was the James Bond villain, Renard. And I've just always seen him as bad guys and stuff. And I'm like, why do they just, the older I get, he just gets hotter and hotter. And I'll watch him and stuff from the 90s and everything. And I'm like, oh my God, I get it. Anyway. Oh,
absolutely. No, he definitely is very sexy to me. And he's sexy in this film. And he's crazy in Trainspotting, but you know. I mean, Ewan McGregor, the face card does not lie on that man. So he's like the best thing in that movie. But like, you know, also Moaning Myrtle's there. I really like that. It's really fun.
So. You know, she made the worst episode of Doctor Who mildly enjoyable.
Right. I don't know which one that is, but, you know.
She also is in Bridget Jones's Diary.
She is in Bridget Jones's Diary, and she's in Marie Antoinette, and and in Trainspotting, and yeah, something like that. It all comes back to Bridget Shirley Jones's.
Anderson. Oh shit, are we allowed to swear?
What do you think?
Okay,
believe you me, I'm somebody who I do not care. I have the little explicit on here, and I say the F slur a couple times every so often. So you know what?
It's fine. Fuck it.
If it makes sense for it, but whatever, it's all good. Anyway, so then we have Jeremy Davies, who I think is really cute. He plays Toffler, who's like the chaplain, if you will, I guess. The man of God. He was in The Black Phone, actually, recently. Have you seen The Black Phone?
I have seen The Black Phone and thought it was fine.
You're like, it's okay.
Okay, so in as few words as possible. The worst thing about that movie shouldn't have been the dad spanking his daughter that she goes home to him. Like, that was the most traumatic thing in that movie about a child killer. It just went really a sense of danger. Kill a kid, you know? Just kill a kid. One.
Fuck it.
Something.
Just go ahead.
You know?
Right. Yeah. Cowards. Whatever. It's fine. He was also in Twister, apparently, which I guess is getting a fucking sequel? Twisters? Yes.
I am trying so hard to not watch the trailer for it because I hate watching trailers because they spoil stuff, but I fucking love Twister and I'm so excited.
You're like, fuck yeah. Give me that shit. It's so great. I mean, listen, it's about a Twister. That's a weather phenomenon, baby. You can't make that up.
I live in Indiana.
So I guess
scary.
I mean, I live in Maryland, so we just have like rain so every so often, and I don't know, whatever the fuck. And then in my notes, I have Jeffrey Jones, who plays, I don't care what his character's name is, and all I just have in my notes is ew with a bunch of W's. reminiscent of the Bratz meme of the shoe when the girl sees it and she's just like, ew. Yeah, that's where we're gonna leave it at. Okay, because fucking disgusting. It could be the ew meme, it's the disgusting meme, it's all of the things, all of it. So fuck Jeffrey Jones, don't fuck all of his performances because he's been in like really iconic movies, but like fuck him, hope he dies. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah,
but anyway, he's not even the best part of this movie, so good for him.
No.
But yeah, so yeah, fuck him. But Steven Spinella, who plays Fort Knox, Major Knox, who's like the second in command of this fucking like fort, I guess. He is actually from the movie Milk, with gay Sean Penn, and then also Connie and Carla, which is not gay Toni Collette and not gay that chick from what's her name, or My Big Fat Greek Wedding,
Nia Vardalho.
Is that one? Yes, I need to watch Connie and Carla. I'll get around to it.
Oh man, I just feel like My Big Fat Greek Wedding was a good one-time thing.
And then they made like 3 sequels of it, and you're like, what the fuck?
She was fun in Chucky recently, but...
Oh, cute. Oh, yeah, you're right. She wasn't... I haven't watched the Chucky series like that. I've watched a couple episodes, but you are right. She was in that. You're very correct.
It was surprisingly good.
Love that. Yeah. Don't worry. We're going to do cut... We're doing some Chucky content this year, too. Don't you worry about that. It's going to happen. But yeah, Steven Spinella, he's also a Tony Award winner. Do you know who he's from? You know him at all?
Mm-mm.
Oh, so Steven Spinella. So like I said, he was in those movies, but he was also a Tony Award winner because have you ever heard of Angels in America ever?
Yes. I've not listened to it personally, but I'm aware of it.
Right. You're aware of it. It's a play. Yes. It has a soundtrack. It was a literal, like, it won the Pulitzer Prize, I think. It won Tony's, and it won our man a Tony because he played Pryor in it, which is like kind of the main character of the movie. If you want, there is, if you have HBO Max at all, you I can do. Watch it. Yeah. You can watch it. I know, right? It's the best $15 I could have spent. But but HBO actually did a miniseries of it, which is actually fairly good. So, because I love Angels in America. I studied theater in college. So, like, you know, I've read that play. I've watched that movie. It's worth a watch. It has Mary Louise Parker, Meryl Streep. You're like done. That's it. Emma Thompson, Jeffrey Wright, who's just kind of come back in vogue because of American Fiction, but he's amazing. Justin Kirk, who he's the brother in Weeds to Mary Louise mm-hmm. Parker,
who was also very good in Succession recently.
Yes, he is. I haven't watched Succession, but I guess he's in that show, which is cool. But he has comedic roots as well. But he was Pryor, which Steven Spinella did. Yeah, watch Angels in America, everybody. If you have an HBO Max subscription and you want to watch about gay stuff and you want to give a few hours of your life, go ahead and do it. I will always sing the praises. And then David Arquette's in it as well. He's in this movie. So he plays... What's his name
stoner.
Again? He's the stoner. I don't remember his name though, but yes, he's the stoner of the
Cleves.
Stoner. Cleves, yes, you're right.
Private
you're right.
Cleves.
Yeah.
I don't remember military. For,
something like that. Yeah. He's like private or some shit like that. Who knows? He is, of course, from Scream, 12 Hour Shift, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, 1992. What is it? Former Mr. Courtney Cox. Which is yes. cool. And also, rest in peace, but, you know, the brother of legend herself, Alexis Arquette, obviously.
Yes.
Come on. You know what I have to say? We don't talk about Alexis Arquette enough. Okay? We really don't.
I just talked about her very recently.
Good. So you should.
We just covered Pulp Fiction and talked about her. So.
Fuck yeah. Like, in that before
I feel
transition.
So self-righteous right now, like I do Fuck talk yeah. about Alexis Arquette.
No, you should, because she's iconic. Like that she was in Spun with you know, the people who were in Spun, Jason Schwartzman and all them, Brittany Murphy, you know, that she's an icon. She transitioned like in the 2000s when it was fucking hard. She unfortunately passed away due to complications of HIV AIDS. Rest in power, queen. We love Alexis Arquette in this house. On the surreal life, bitch, like amazing. Like, oh god, anyway. I'm glad that when you covered Pulp Fiction, you had to give a little bit of moment to Miss Alexis Arquette. So there you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Patricia's not the only one that talks about her.
Exactly. Good on Patricia, at least. She's at least saying, like, hey, remember I had a sister? Because mm-hmm. people don't remember. And that's what's crazy, too. Not to go on a tangent. Like, I do go on tangents every so often. But, like, yeah, it's like, maybe she was, like, one of the first mm-hmm. to, like, it was, like, her and Chaz Bono, I guess, you know? But, like, Alexis Arquette was out there, bitch. She was just living her trans life, and, you know, also coming from a really famous family, I guess, too. That also has its own added stresses, but, like,
oh my god, it'd be so stressful.
Yeah, I mean, and it was, I mean, like, we're not that far apart in age. I'm 31. How old are you again?
35, thank you.
Okay, no, but 35. No. So you're like my sister's age, so we're, like, literally not that far apart in age, like, right. at all. And so, like, yeah, no, we legit lived through the 2000s as, like, teenagers slash, like, young, yeah, like, teenagers. Yeah. Bitch, it was hard, everybody. For anybody who doesn't already know, like, shit was weird. You know, it was not the same as it was back then. So it's like, you know.
There's a reason we all have anxiety.
Literally. Oh my god. And that we're all just like that we're all trying to not, like, we're trying to break our bad habits of, like, you know, try to be skinny all the time and shit like that, you know. there wasn't that much body positivity back then. There wasn't anything, there wasn't a whole lot for gay people like that, you know what I mean?
There was literally a term in fashion, heroin chic, like,
yeah. And I mean, yeah, it's still a fucking thing in terms of just like, you know, fashion and shit like that, but it was a lot, there was some harsh times, man. So any young viewer, listeners, people, whatever the hell, the youths, hello fellow kids. But you know, I don't know. It's hard to explain what it was, but also it's not that hard in a way, because I'm like, yeah, you know, it's fucking in White Chicks
when she's like, Dina, the talking tummy. The day I wake up and still just think that about myself. It's hard to break.
It really is. And also Jennifer Carpenter is an icon. We forget. Lest we forget. Miss former Mrs.
Michael C. Hall.
Amazing. So we're just chit-chat at this point, which is fine, because this movie, like, listen. So talking a little bit about the, I guess if there's anybody else to really talk about too, we do have our icons that are Joseph Running Fox, who plays George in the movie, who is also a Native person, which is cool. They had that. And also Martha as well, who, spoiler alert, everybody, but she does make it in the end, which is awesome. So yes. Love that for her. But those are both people of you know, Native descent. So love to see it. Love that. Try to see if there's anybody else in particular. Not really a whole lot of other cast members to talk about. Do you have anybody else on the crew that you want to like talk about, shout out?
Oh, I just wanted to mention Neil McDonough, because he just always freaks me out. And so watching him play a good guy just upsets me. I was introduced to him from Desperate Housewives, and I've seen him play a lot of villain sense, and yeah, anyway, that was my only comment on anybody else in the crew.
That's fair. I didn't have much to say about him, but you're right. He's also very hot in this movie, and his intro I just love, because he's just like in a like river just screaming with his shirt off. Iconic. Love. Amazing. Anyway, so yeah, but that's a little bit about cast, crew, things like that. Now we're gonna talk a little bit about the production of this movie, so feel free to chime in, Clayton, with anything. But this movie in particular, like I said, it came out from 20th Century Fox, and it was one of three screenplays that was written by Ted Griffin that he sold to the studio in a week. So this was loosely inspired by the Donner Party. This is not a history podcast, but the Donner Party was pretty much these settlers who were going across the country. They were told, hey, get my like guides or whatever, and I have a super cool shortcut. And the guy who sold them the brochures didn't have a fucking cool shortcut. And then they ended up getting stranded, and they had to eat each other, is like the pretty much basic of it. As well as earlier, like I said, Alfred Packer, who is a prospector and former Union army soldier who murdered a bunch of people, like ate them, and then claimed to law enforcement that he did so out of self-defense and survival, which again influenced the character of Calhoun in this film. And so then in 97, Macedonian director Milcho Menchevsky, I guess, I had to sound that out, baby. Listen.
Just go for it, say it confidently, and go. We'll all believe it.
Fuck it. Let's do it. Please listen to my Perfect Blue episode, because I love that movie. Those Japanese names were kicking my ass. I had to sound all those out, because listen. And don't you worry, I'm also doing a soon enough, another Japanese movie, okay? And those are probably gonna kick my ass too, but you know, it's fine. We ball, we here. But yeah, so this guy, Macedonian dude, was set to direct this movie, and all right, cool, great, boom, let's make this thing. So this movie was actually shot in Slovakia, also in the Tatra Mountains, which I believe is in Slovakia and Poland, like, really? Right around there. Yeah. And it was also done in Durango, Mexico, right? So, all right, cool. We're on location, all this good shit, right? So 1 week before production, the director had submitted new storyboards, which would have required an additional 2 weeks of shooting. They eventually agreed on an additional week, with complaints that the director had refused to attend production meetings with the producers. And the director claimed that Laura Ziskin, who has since passed away as well, pretty much micromanaged the production by vetoing his chosen technicians and casting against his wishes. So it was delayed on the first day. So the shooting was delayed on this first day as the director and the production were still negotiating over like the budget and the shooting schedule. And not that I'm a filmmaker, and Clayton, I don't think you're a filmmaker, right, either, correct? Oh,
absolutely not.
But as gays who like movies and who know maybe a thing or two about them, is it a pretty good idea to already have your production schedule and your budget maybe thought out before you start shooting? Wouldn't you think that's maybe a good idea?
I mean, for a studio film like this, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so that didn't happen, though. It's bad. That's really bad. So as filming commenced, pretty much the director was saying that Ziskin was sending him notes on the rushes every day, which rushes are just like dailies, I think, mm-hmm. like of footage, complaining about the amount of dirt on the costumes and also the amount of close-ups on this movie. And the screenwriter was on hand for, quote, constant rewrites during the shoot. So yeah, about 3 weeks into this production, into filming, pretty much what happened was that Ziskin was like, yeah, no, fuck you. We're firing you. So they fired him, and then they replaced him with a little director by Raja Gosnell. Do you know who that is?
The name sounds vaguely familiar.
So Raja Gosnell, for those who don't know, he may have directed a movie with Miss Drew Barrymore called Never Been Kissed. I don't know if you've heard of it. And he also did both live-action Scooby-Doo movies as well.
All three are iconic cinema with a capital C.
He also did like Yours, Mine, and Ours. He did the two Smurfs movies that came out in the 2010s, all that kind of shit. So yeah, Beverly Hills Chihuahua, I guess, apparently too. And yeah, he's done a couple things here and there. He was also an editor as well. So he edited like Mrs. Doubtfire. He was a part of that. He was like, he edited like Pretty Woman and Home Alone. He was part of the editing on there too. So, you know. So yeah, they brought in Raja Gosnell, and they were like, also, I did watch the sequel of Scooby-Doo. That movie is shockingly good. Like,
shockingly good.
Like, it should not be that good, but it's actually pretty decent. Like, seriously. That hot geek Seth Green. Listen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although the director left the production, the cast, though, was unhappy with Gosnell and pretty much, like, apparently, allegedly, held a mutiny on the set and was pretty much like, no, we don't like this guy. Or they maybe just thought he was not the right fit for this, let's just say.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And then Robert Carlyle, though, our buddy, our Scottish buddy, he recommended Antonia Bird. He actually frequently collaborated with her and was kind of a business partner of hers as well. And Bird had a previous business relationship with Ziskin, and she really liked the script, so they brought her on. After about 10 days of negotiation, they brought her to Prague, where she took over the production, and she too would criticize the circumstances under which the filming was to take place, describing the allocated studio space as, quote, horrible, and the scheduling of the shoot, quote, manipulative. And she also went on to say that her predecessor, the director, Mielcho, should not have been blamed for the problematic production, which I think that is some queen shit right there, because she is not throwing anybody else under the bus like that, which is really, really nice. And do you know what it sounds like to me?
Sounds like studios are just annoying to work with.
Yep. And it sounds like that one lady, that Ziskin lady, was a nightmare to work with. So,
well, Laura was a strong personality.
Yep.
But so she did get shit done.
She did. But also if you're allegedly like complaining about the dirt on film in a fort like this, what's going on here? You know,
who knows? Studios are idiots.
No, that is a good kind of button to that, is that, yeah. Again, you know, not trying to come down too hard on Ziskin. I guess she has a hand in it because she has to, because she's in the studio, but it's also like, yeah, what the fuck, though? Like, you couldn't figure out who to get, like, anyway, I don't know. And also not trying to find solutions either, you know what I mean? That's the other part of it as well. But when you're up to that point, when you're an executive producer, when you're in that kind of a thing, morals be damned sometimes, seriously.
Yes.
Logic sometimes goes out the window. But anyway, so then it sounded like a nightmare to shoot, unfortunately, but they did shoot this movie. And Bird suggested that the final theatrical cut had elements introduced without her approval, though, such as like the voiceover narration of this movie, and also explanatory quotes that kind of are just exposition dumps. And she felt that these elements were superfluous and expressed a desire in recutting the film for the European market, since she herself is a Brit. So that's what we have in terms of just, like, you know, the filming history and all that. Do you have anything else to add that you have ever found of that, or anything that maybe I didn't already mention?
No, I didn't dig too deeply on it because I didn't want to spoil anything you might have had. I can do that sometimes. So I was just like, I'm just going to watch it. And I know what I already know about the people that are involved, and I'm going with that.
It works for me. Yeah. I mean, it just seemed like this was kind of hell to shoot, but they ended up getting through it, which was fine. And that's all nice and good.
Yeah, I knew it was troubled, but not like to that level of extent.
Yeah, it just, you know, I don't think it was a fun shoot, let's just say. Let's just put that there. Yeah, and then this movie came out, and like we said, it only made about $2 million in the U.S. I don't really think it went overseas, so it didn't make that much money. But honestly, though, critically, it at least got over a 50, which isn't terrible. It's halfway. There's some shit that got really bad critical reviews. Go see Jawbreaker, you know?
Sorority Row. It's got an abysmal
Sorority Row, but like, is it a fun movie? Yeah, kind of. Like, it's, you know, it's not that terrible. You know what I mean? Out of a lot of those, like, remakes and shit, it makes sense, you know?
I fucking love Sorority Row. So
I did an episode on it too, and I loved it.
I started listening to it because I was like, I wonder what I'm in for. Because, like, most of the time I will be like, yeah, I'll come on a podcast. And then I just jump in. And I was like, hey, I'm actually going to listen to some and be like, okay, what is this person's personality? So I'm not completely surprised. And I was like, ooh, he did an episode on Sorority Row.
Yeah, with a whole other gay too. So it's all good.
Yes. Love Sorority Row. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think audiences, like, were confused about the tone of this movie, which, not surprised by that at all. It has this kind of horror, black comedy, satire, Western shit going on too. Yeah, it's just all kind of over the place, but that's not horrible though. It's just the tone is muddled, if anything. But that's what kind of makes it an interesting movie, because I mean, what would you categorize this as if you had to,
like, what genre?
Yeah,
I would say horror.
Yeah, I think it's horror,
but you're right, it is kind of hard to call. But
yeah, I think it's a horror. It's a Western horror to me, but it's also, like, it's not super funny though, which is funny because it has, like, the dark comedy in it. There's a little bit of that, but, like, no, I think it's also just like a Western horror, really. You know, it's talking about that, you know, which I think is cool. Yeah,
the tones are a little bit, because on the one hand, it's like a super serious, like, horrifying story. And on the other hand, it has this almost camp sensibility with, like, the sexual tension between them. It's just like, what?
Yeah, definitely. We'll talk a little bit more about that too as we talk about the plot and characters and stuff. But yeah, this has gotten, like, a cult following. So David Ehrlich wrote for Rolling Stone. He said, quote, Ravenous butchers the fantasy that the United States is a banquet with room for everyone at the table. This is a landscape where, quote, manifest destiny becomes a handy euphemism for all sorts of horrors, and a reminder that progress was never possible without savagery. The frontier was the Hunger Games, and it always has been. This may not be breaking news, but the film isn't interested in telling you something that you don't know, only showing it to you in a way so giddy and gruesome that you'll never be able to forget it. Which is very true. I think the themes of manifest destiny that come through this, and just, like, capitalism in general and all of this, like, it goes through. But yeah, no, I think that this movie does, if anything, like, it does show, in my view, it does show this movie isn't, like, a glamorous depiction of what it was like at this time or anything like that, which I thought was really refreshing in a way. I think
looked miserable.
It looked miserable, and it's not any of that kind of shit. I mean, it's like these things going back to Thanksgiving, you know, like, because it's on Netflix, right, which I'm gonna watch with something like that. We talk about Thanksgiving and we teach it in, you know, elementary school and shit, but, like, it was not happy, like, okay, like, bad. No. bad. And so when we talk about this time in history and the westward settlement and, you know, all that kind of stuff, it's not glamorous or anything. Not that we're expecting it to be, but, like, it isn't, and there's some really fucked up shit going on, you know.
Yeah.
And I think also this, I wish would have gone more international because I think it probably would have done better.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm still just kind of surprised. This cast was hot at the time. Like, I think it's well done. Like, there's a whole lot worse you could do with your time.
Absolutely. I agree. But yeah, so, I mean, that's a little bit about just like the overall legacy of the movie or just some of the reception it had and all that stuff. But Clayton, I have a task for you.
Okay.
So my task for you is if you were to have to explain this movie to somebody who maybe has never seen it before, how would you describe the plot of Ravenous?
Well, I can answer that for you very, very easily. I would point them to what I just logged on Letterboxd. I just said, horniest gay love story of 1999.
Perfect. It's good. It makes total sense.
That's
yeah. No, it does. Because yes, absolutely. I'd follow you on Letterboxd too. I'll do that probably after the show. But yeah, no, I think this movie, well, we could talk about it now, I guess. I mean, y'all, this movie is so gay, and I'm here for it. And do you want to speak a little bit on, like, why do you think this movie is just so fucking gay?
I mean, did you see it?
I did see, like, it.
I don't know. Just once Robert Carlyle is introduced into this plot, it just instantly gets super, super homosexual. And I love it. I love it so much. It's funny. It's kind of hot. It's so much subtext. Yeah. And you can't spell subtext without sex.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's very true. And I also, I don't have it pulled up or anything, but I'm pretty sure Robert Carlyle has actually gone on record to say that with the character of Calhoun, he did play it up as kind of this like gay thing. Because, yeah, I mean, he is kind of that, like, outsider coming into this fort, right? But, you know, I completely understand. He seems like he's having the most fun ever. But, like, you know, I think he does play it in a way where you're just like, what's going on with this guy? What's he doing? Like, you know.
I mean, he's constantly talking to Boyd about his virility and all this stuff. And just...
Yeah,
how you just need to accept it. And like, it's a seduction. I mean, this essentially, even though it's like technically a Wendigo and cannibalism, like, it's a vampire story. And
yeah, he's trying
to seduce him to be his partner. Like, it's this whole story. It's so funny.
It's true. Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, it is this just like, spoilers for everybody. I mean, obviously, this is a podcast, like, we're gonna spoil shit. But like, you know, at the end of the movie, like, you have them in a bear trap together, just like, dead. You're just like, okay. All right.
So like, what? Even before the bear trap, they're just standing in front of each other face to face, and I'm just like shouting at the screen, like, now kiss. And then he holds him, lays him down in the bear trap. Like, I mean, it is such a, like, I'm tenderly laying you on the bed. We are about to have intercourse right now. And then the bear trap snaps shut, and then like Robert Carlyle's like, I am definitely going to eat you. And I'm just like, oh my god.
Yes. Oh my god. No, it's when you see it, or if you're just like horrible homosexuals like we are, no, it's hard not to see it. Like, really. You're just like, what is this? And you're kind of wondering, like, I guess this was a little intentional to do that in a way. I feel like it's there, like, completely, which is, I think, why there's been people who, like yourself, or like even me, or whoever else, I think there are plenty of gay people who are like, oh yeah, no, this movie's gay as shit. Like, what do you mean? Like, absolutely. Like,
I think it's impossible to watch this movie and not be like, no, this is gay as fuck. And if you didn't see that, like, were you watching the movie, or are you like literally dumb?
Yeah. And I think what's really cool too is like just the fact of having a woman director there as well. I feel like there is this level, because you know how sometimes, like, not that I watch a ton of like action-packed, like, dudes being dudes movies kind of a thing, right?
You know, kind of fun.
They're kind of fun, but like, there is this level of like machismo there, obviously, and you're just like, okay, it's just bros being bros, right? What I think is really cool about having this female director in here is that it doesn't, with this movie that is filled with men in it, where there's one woman, but there's all these men here, I feel like there's a level There is no level of machismo in this. There is none of that, really. Like you said, it's the sexual tension that's there, but also there's a level of, I don't know if it's sensitivity necessarily, but this is also just like reason 1970 where female directors are just really fucking good.
Yeah, a man directing this movie, it would have been a totally different thing.
Absolutely. And I don't even know what, you know, the dude who did it first, like, I don't know what his like goal was with the tone or whatever, you know, I don't know what his end product would have been, but like, I just feel like having a woman do this, like, there is a level of sensitivity in here, and also just like a different, I don't know, je ne sais quoi, if you will. Like, there is just that. There's that vibe there where I'm just like, you know, a man would have done that. He would have fucked this up. You could argue that it's already fucked up because it didn't do well, like, financially. But, like, no, I think, like, it, the vibe of this, I love the fact that it's directed by a woman because you can tell in a way. Yeah. Which, on the flip side, I will be doing Ginger Snaps at some point on this podcast. I don't know when, but I will. I think it's really fascinating that that movie was written by a woman but was directed by a man. But it doesn't feel like it was directed by a man.
It is one of the few exceptions.
Which is crazy to me. I'm just like, that is just like, that one is good. But anyway, so... Yeah, but I like your plot. I love that. I guess before we kind of dive into any sort of the characters of the movie or anything like that, and maybe talk about the plot just in general, I do want to talk a little bit about the themes of the movie, just a little bit. I already mentioned a little bit about it anyway. This is set in the 1840s, and I think that and the act of cannibalism, from what Wikipedia tells me, it's really critiquing Manifest Destiny. If you don't already know what Manifest Destiny is, not you, Clayton, but listeners, it is the assertion by specifically white men of the time that they just were entitled to like expand in America, pretty much, is what Manifest Destiny is. So like, what else is beyond like the fucking 13 colonies, pretty much, right? So we need to go westward. We need to explore America, quote unquote.
So I'm just going to throw myself under the bus here. I... had a light bulb moment during this movie about Manifest Destiny. I always was like, you know, it's about westward expansion, all this stuff, you know. Went to a good school. I got good grades. History wasn't, you know, my best subject, but and something about the way Robert Carlyle said Manifest Destiny, I was just, you know, I'm a stoner. And I was just like, oh, like Manifest Destiny. Because I was always just like, why did they call it Manifest Destiny? Like, it doesn't even make any sense. But I was just like, it was like, you know, seeing a speaker that's like, no, just Manifest Destiny. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm 35 years old and I get it.
High thoughts with Clayton. I love it.
Yeah.
No, it's true. And so, like, you know, it's definitely critiquing that, you know.
Yeah,
and
also
it's not subtle at all. Just colonialism in general, you know, which of course is just like people coming to a fucking place and just, you know, being colonial and shit, and like, you know, saying, oh no, we're here. And so that's what happened with, like, obviously slavery. They were like, oh no, these African people, no, you're coming with us and we're gonna like enslave you. Isn't that gonna be fun? Yeah. Not at all. Or, oh hey, we're gonna like discover America, even though literally there were already people here, and we've like completely wrecked them systematically and for the rest of their lives.
Yeah,
fucked up. And also just capitalism in general,
we're the best.
White people, like, disgusting. And then also just capitalism, because we live it every day, baby. Listen, so fun times. As Bird quoted as saying, as a European, observing early Californian history and making a film about that, I kind of believe that Europeans were responsible for a lot of stuff that happened here, which is true. And Robert Carlyle's character represents that. The Europeans practiced genocide. And I think the good things about America, we're Europeans, not responsible for. That's something that she said about that. Although she also said this film is, quote, more about social misfits than the whole seductive nature of power, she stated. She said, I quote, would like to think that someone who enjoyed it, the movie Ravenous, only as gallows humor, would start to think. The metaphor of power and a society that we're encouraged to be competitive is, to me, not a great society. Thus, cannibalism can be seen as a critique of, quote, contemporary America, where the way of life seems to be more and more a matter of consume or be consumed. She's just dropping some bars there, is what I feel like.
That's so funny she said that, because I was watching this and I was kind of thinking about it through a queer lens, because, you know, when you're watching something for a podcast, you think about it like a little bit differently. And I was just like, this is so like a queer story, because there is this big search for a need for family and community and belonging. And I was just like, huh. And, you know, as queers, we love a story about a found family. It's, you know, just to gravitate toward that. So, yeah.
Absolutely. It does have it all. Could have used at least a butt or two, but I am willing to.
There is a butt. You see Robert Carlyle's butt.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Oh, I was not even paying attention like that. Damn it.
I noticed it.
I'm glad. But yeah, so in addition, she also said that the cannibalism can be an interpretation as an addiction to drugs or a yearning for eternal youth, which manifests in modern day Western society as the consumption of junk food or the obsession with plastic surgery. Robert Carlyle's character is the ultimate drug pusher, and Guy Pearce's character is the ultimate junkie, is what she said. Which kind of, you know.
It does fit. I struggled with addiction and stuff, and I'm in recovery, and like, it does fit. But I still just think it's more like, come on, come out of the closet. You know, just come on.
I agree.
Accept yourself.
Exactly. But yeah, so I guess definitely think those are the themes of this film. I guess if anything, like to put on to what a plot is, pretty much what happens is that Captain John Boyd, he is a coward who pretty much fought in the Mexican-American War. He pretty much played dead and got behind enemy lines, and he like took over the enemy base, but he did it by being a coward. So because of this, his higher ups ship him off to Fort Spencer in the middle of California in 1840s with a ragtag team of people, militia that are there, who that includes Private Cleves, who is a private, played by David Arquette. Private Toffler, who's the chaplain, played by Jeremy Davies.
So cute.
Colonel Hart. Yes, he's so cute. Colonel Hart, who's played by Jeffrey Jones. Blah. And so then General Slauson is the guy. It's his boss. That's his boss. Major Knox, who's Steven Spinella, who is a constant drunk and alcoholic, who just sleeps all the time, pretty much. Yes. And then Private Reich as well, who's kind of like the soldier of the group, played by Neil McDonough. And then you also have
extremely blue eyes.
Yes, absolutely. And then also you have kind of the native representation and really the guides for these people, who are George and Martha, who are brother and sister. Although, fun little fact I put in my notes, that it was actually supposed to be two brothers. Mm-hmm. And they changed it at the last minute.
Probably because she was awesome.
Yeah.
Also with not subtle commentary on, oh, they were here when we got here. We just kind of inherited them. Like,
right. Yeah.
I was exactly. Like, oh, this movie isn't subtle, but I like it.
Exactly. So anyway, that's who makes up this militia, this Fort Spencer, if you will. Anyway,
found family, if you will.
Found family. Anyway, so this outsider comes, and they he comes across this fort. This is Calhoun, who is played by Robert Carlyle, who's Scottish, and he's also Scottish in the movie. But anyway, he pretty much says like, hey, I've been like walking around for 3 months. Pretty much this thing happened where like I got into this, I was with these people like heading west, and some shit happened. We had to pretty much like hide in a cave because fucking shit went down, and then we had to like resort to eating each other, and it fucking sucked, and I was able to somehow survive, and then this is how I'm on your doorstep now, pretty much, once he comes to. And then what we end up finding out is that, well, Calhoun, because they're like, oh, well, there's at least a woman who's still, I think, alive in this place. So, like, let me lead you there and we can go save her. So, because they're like, that's our jobs. Like, we have to go and, like, save this woman who's in peril, because women are in peril in the 1840s.
Yes.
Yes. But anyway, so.
Not Martha, though.
Not Martha, though. She's a bad bitch. But yeah, so they go. Knox stays behind because he's a drunk. But everybody else goes, and, you know, they end up finding the cave and all this. And they go in the cave. They have Boyd and Reich go in the cave, and they end up finding the remains of all these people. And then they find out, oh, wait a minute, the way that this is all set up, because they find all the skeletons and all this shit, there's actually no woman that's alive. And pretty much it was a whole trap that was set up by Calhoun, who we end up finding out is what is called a Wendigo. Do you have any information about what a Wendigo is that you want to share or anything like that?
My main knowledge of Wendigo is from movies that aren't super great and a few episodes of Supernatural, so I probably should not speak on this. But yeah, again, like, I see this much more as just kind of another vampire story, more than even sure. a cannibal or Wendigo tale. It's more of a, like, just another form of vampire.
Yeah, sure.
And how the story plays out, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So for anybody who's wondering what a Wendigo is, actually, if you just watch this movie, you get a pretty good idea of what a Wendigo is, actually. Yeah. But pretty much what it is, it's, according to Wikipedia, it is a malevolent spirit, sometimes depicted as a creature with human-like characteristics that possesses human beings. And it is said to cause its victims an insatiable hunger, the desire to eat other humans, and the propensity to commit murder. Sometimes there is, like, a giant humanoid creature with, like, a heart of ice whose approach is signaled by a foul stench or sudden unseasonable chill, when really, actually, I think more so that the Wendigo is not like Bigfoot or something. It's more so this kind of entity that possesses people, in the example in this movie of what happened to Calhoun. So
yeah,
it's more so it's a spirit that kind of possesses somebody, and that's what makes them hungry for flesh and
cancer. And also, I think in a lot of things that I've seen on it, like, if you eat the flesh of someone else, that's how you become one. So
sure, like, yeah, absolutely. Yep, so that's from two white people, that's what a Wendigo is. Yeah. But
there you go, you know,
take that. There you go. but and I'm sure if you want to do your own research, you know, I honestly think I have not seen Antlers or anything. I know that also has a Wendigo aspect. Nah. I personally would say, from what I've gathered from people, I think Ravenous actually does the Wendigo story pretty decent, which is good. So
I think it is the best depiction, honestly, I've seen, probably.
Yeah, I would agree from what I've gathered too. So that's nice. Anyway, so then now it's pretty much this cat and mouse game going on between Calhoun and Boyd, because pretty much everyone is killed at this fucking hanging rock place or whatever the fuck. So they kill, like, George, unfortunately. They kill Boyd, Jeffrey Jones, blah. They pretty much kill all these other people. Reich ends up dying as well. He's not killed by Calhoun, but I think he just dies because he tries fighting him and all that, if I'm not mistaken. Boyd is pretty much, no, they don't kill Boyd. I'm sorry. They kill Hart. That's Jeffrey Jones. Boyd is Guy Pearce. Anyway, so all these names are like, everyone feels similar to me in a way.
Just like actor.
These actors. And so I'm just Toffler. Like, wait, who is this? Exactly. Oh, they do kill Toffler. It's very sad.
I know.
Anyway. He was just minding his own business and just praying to the Lord, but you know,
and look where it got him.
God damn it! Right, but anyway, so but yeah, but what ends up happening is Boyd pretty much like hides out, and he's just like, "Fuck, I gotta like be able to get back to the fort." So he ends up slowly but surely he like has to leave Reich at his body. He ends up, you know, being able to get back to the fort. Which
he
is left nice. Out
the fact that he eats him.
He does eat him. You're right. I totally forgot about that. He does eat him.
Which is how he walks him. Back from a leg injury where his bone was sticking out of his leg. So
that's exactly why I have you here, Clayton. Okay. Yeah. You gotta keep me on track. I know. It's gross. Oh, and the other thing with that too is that just the like him having to like reset his like fucking like broken ass leg and stuff, like it's gross to me. Like, ugh. I'm a horror fan, like, and I love
horror, and I think this does it very well. Like, I always forget, like, man, it's really gory. Gross. It's got some real gross stuff in it. It's got really yes. good practical effects. Like,
oh, bring completely. It. Bring it. I love it. Like, yeah, ugh. It's not like overall scary necessarily. I don't think it's supposed to be, but like it does some stuff really well. So I like that. Anyway, as you stated, yes, he ends up after eating Reich, he's able to make it back to the fort. And then we end up finding out. So Cleves and Martha were still there too. They were still hanging out because they went off and were buying stuff in town, and then they had to come back. So they weren't going on the mission, obviously. But that's why George went. But anyway, so like he gets back to the fort and all this, and he's pretty much saying like, hey, look, like this is what went on. Like this guy is a fucking like, because even George was like, you're a fucking Wendigo, dude. Like you are absolutely a monster. Like what the fuck's wrong with you? He doesn't trust, like George doesn't trust him at all. Like he doesn't trust Calhoun at all. But then he ends up getting killed, unfortunately. But yeah, Boyd makes his way back. He's like, yo, this is what happened with this fucking guy. And what is it that they end up sending Ives? How does he come in the story again?
Well, since everyone was gone for some reason or other, mm-hmm. you know, whatever your official story may be on that, they've got to have a replacement. And so somehow he was able to get in there. I don't know what his former rank was, if he actually had military service, because, you know, he had talked about Colonel Ives.
Yes.
Whatever. And we assumed he had eaten him, but it was like actually him. But yeah, so he just did it.
Snakes his way back in there.
They don't tell us. I try not to think about it too hard.
Right.
Familiar enough about the interpersonal politics and logistics of HR in 1840s military bases.
As somebody who worked in HR for at least a good 3 years before, I don't think it existed back then. So there's that. But anyway, so yeah, but they send him out, and then Colonel Ives ends up being Calhoun pretty much. And what ends up happening is that also we find out that Ives, because he ended up doing this, because remember, like Boyd was kind of by himself and he had to eat his friend. So then Calhoun just went back and just like took the form of Ives, and then like he's now been running shit. So he's just like, oh no, like Boyd is like, oh fuck no, like he's a fucking Wendigo, like he's a bad dude, all this shit, right? And so we find out though that Hart, he actually is been brought back to life, I guess, because of man stew, I guess you could call it. They just kill people and they make a stew of it and they eat it, and they're like, we ball, like we're here, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so that's exactly what happens. So they bring Hart back to life, and they end up killing Major Knox, which is unfortunate. They kill him, and they also stab Boyd as well. And they're like, you need to eat. Why are you, like you were saying, like, just give in to it. Like, just do it, right? Like, you know, just be one of us pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens.
Incredibly homoerotic speech.
Absolutely, yes.
Where Robert Carlyle says, it's not courage to resist me, it's courage to accept me. You're already one of us. Come on.
Exactly.
Be gay, do crime.
Be gay, do crimes. Love it. But yes. So yeah, and then we're seeing kind of the things going on. So obviously, like, Boyd isn't really talking to Ives a whole lot, because he's like, no, that's a fucking monster. And him and Hart have a whole conversation as well. But then, if I'm not mistaken, Hart is all like, yeah, like, this is cool at first to, like, do this, and it was cool to, like, get brought back to life and shit like that, but I can't keep doing this forever, and I can't keep this on, so, like, you know what? Kill me, pretty much, which is what he asks Boyd to do. And so Boyd kills him, because he's like, pretty much, mercy, kill me, because I can't keep living like this.
Yeah, I made a note about that, because I just found it interesting with what we know about him as a person. And I do think, I mean, as far as his performance, I think he was quite good. But when he that line, I can't live like this anymore, like, kill me, I was like, wonder how deep he had to dig for that.
I wonder.
I was just sitting there like, yeah. Anyway, that's my only note on him in this entire film.
That's fine with me. But yeah, but then this kind of sets into motion the end of the film, where pretty much like Ives has called for like reinforcements, I guess, quote unquote, to come. And like, because what he's pretty much doing is like, he's saying like, hey, we don't have a whole lot of people here anymore. We need more militia. Because what he's going to do is he's pretty much going to do the motel hell of it all. And he's just going to, like, kill the people that come there. And then that's what's going to keep him going, pretty much. Because he's been doing that for however long now. Because who's to even say that Ives and his previous expedition was the first time he ever did this. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
But anyway, so this sets into motion the end of the movie where pretty much, so
we get a Boyd, super long improvised fight scene.
We do, yes. Pretty much Boyd and Boyd is going after, I want to call him Begbie, but it's not Begbie, it's Calhoun. They want to go after him. They're going after each other. They fight, all this kind of shit. But yeah, I mean, that's pretty much how it ends, is that like they are standing off to one against one another. Cleves has been killed, unfortunately, which is very sad. R.I.P. David Arquette. We love you. But yeah.
He's the stoner in a horror movie.
Love it. Like, he's great.
Gotta die.
But, yeah, exactly. Exactly. But yeah, so it was that. And yeah, they face off for one another and then they end up getting killed. Well, Boyd ends up killing Calhoun by trapping him in a bear trap. And I love his little line where he says, "That was very sneaky," or something like that. I just think it's just, some of his line delivery is just like off the chain and it's kind of crazy, but I love it. And yeah, and that's when they're like pretty much cuddled on top of each other on a, mm-hmm. a bear trap. And this is Martha having brought these people back. So it's literally I think it's like the other officers from like Boyd's other post. Like, they're coming and surveying this place and they end up finding all this shit. And again, we have a final girl in Martha, which I love for her. And the movie just ends on like a literal like vertical crane shot of these two men just like lying on top of each other under a bear trap. And that's how the movie ends.
Yep. With more crazy score.
More crazy score, amazing. Like, thank you, Damon Albarn. Absolutely. I mean, that's what this movie pretty much is about. But do you have any, I know you probably have some notes as well. Some notes, if you will.
Always.
Always with my Baltimore. But like, do you have any particular like standout scenes of the movie or anything like that that you kind of want to talk about, since we did just talk about what the actual fucking movie's about?
Yeah, I didn't have like a ton. I just had some. First of all, I love movies set in like the mid-1800s. I don't know why. It just like, it's so rugged and out west, and especially if they're like on location. Like, give me an on location like western ish movie. Like, I hate westerns, but like Hateful Eight or this, or just like, I don't know, a genre.
Have you seen Bone Tomahawk?
Yes. Okay. Like, I like genre western, like that wouldn't typically be like a western anyway. But so I'm already in for the vibes of this movie. It's so cold, it makes me, my situation today, it snowed here yesterday, we got 5 inches. I'm a smoker, like I've said, and I have a thing outside because I don't smoke in the house. You know, this little camping like pods you can sit in to like protect you from the cold. Anyway, so I have one of those. And so I sat out there and smoked and in the snow and watched Ravenous. And it was just like 4DX. It was amazing. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, hey, your cinematic experience. I love that for
it
you.
It was. It was what I needed. I was like, you know what? I don't want surround sound in my like theater room. I just need to be on location myself, experience.
Absolutely.
This.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I can get into some movies later, westerns and stuff. I can get into some of those. Like, I think this is a really good example of that. I do want to watch Bone Tomahawk, like, because apparently that shit's wild, but like, I'm here for it. Yeah, any sort of that like little yeehaw type shit. Like, I'm kind of, I could pull up on that a little bit.
And yeah, the men are always so hot.
I bet. Could it also like From Dusk Till Dawn, is that kind of a little bit of that too? Maybe a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And you know, also like, I know it's not the same, but like, this is just me wanting to just talk about Demon Knight at any point I want to, at any point I can. But I will also throw in Demon Knight a little bit there too, bitch. Why not?
I haven't seen it. My co-host Sean, I feel like, really loves that movie.
I love that. I love it for Sean. I really do.
I love that journey for him as well. I just don't see it for myself unless I'm ever forced to for a podcast.
I mean, I don't know if I'm going to force you necessarily, but I mean, I'm just going to keep telling you to go watch it. But that's just me. Any other things like scenes or anything that kind of stand out or any other kind of things? Yes,
he was licking me.
Oh my God, yes. So yeah, that was something I failed to mention when they were going off to the cave or whatever, that they set up camp, and what ends up happening is that Toffler falls off of a cliff or something. He falls off of somewhere.
Would be the worst.
Oh my God, horrible in 1840s. But anyway, so like, he ends up like getting this like wound in his stomach, but he's like, they patch him up and they're like, oh, you'll be fine, walk it off, right? And then, yeah, like in the middle of the night, you have Calhoun is just like licking on him. And then he's just like, and Toffler's just like, fucking like, no, what the hell? And then he's like, he was licking me, which they put in the trailer and it like is awful. Sucks. But yeah, it's wild. And I'm just like,
it's like, it's that's scary. And it's also like, I'm fucked up. So I just think it's super funny. And it's right. also just like, it's kind of sexual. And
oh yeah,
they're like, he was licking me. Like, how terrifying would that be? You're like half dead, you've got a huge hole in your side, and like this creepy little fucker that you know is eating people is just like licking your wound. And he's like, oh, I was just having a bad dream, sir.
Wait, no, you weren't, you fucking weirdo. Like, what are you doing? So I'm not consenting to this.
Since you saw this more recently, I remember when I did like the first big twist. Did it like get you, or were you like, well, of course?
God, I'm trying to think, because I'm trying to remember if I was like listening to that podcast about it first and then I watched it. But I was at least familiar that it was a bit of a Wendigo story, I think, but I didn't know what that meant in terms of this movie. I was like, well, what the hell? What do you mean? Then when I found out that, like, oh, I think it did kind of take me for it, because I was like, oh, wait, yes, yeah, so this guy is just like a fucking villain. He's just like, like monster, isn't he? Okay, all right then, like, you know,
he plays it so like, yeah, he seems so hurt and everything, and then it's like, oh no, he's like the villain, and also like the villain. Mm-hmm. It surprised me, and even though I'm used to Robert Carlyle playing villain roles,
right,
it just shocked me. I was like, oh my god. And then later when he shows back up, I was just like, oh shit, he's like evil, this is great. But like, yeah, Robert Carlyle, that scene where it does have the twist when he's like frantically digging in the dirt like a fucking psychopath,
yeah,
his acting is so fucking good, and then he just drops it all.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then like, oh yeah, no, and then you have the whole thing with like Toffler where he's just like, you know, that is so annoying, right?
Yeah.
And then he's like, and then he's like, so run. Like, he has to tell him like, you need to run for your life.
Toffler he's pretty, but he's very useless.
Yeah, he's pretty. But yeah, that's really it.
Can't even rhyme for his little Bible song.
Oh, I know, right? Yeah, exactly. He has to be told like fervent. What rhymes with servant?
Fervent.
Yes.
I also just shock. Absolute shock when he fucking just leaps off of the cliff out of nowhere.
Oh my god, yeah. You're like, how are you gonna live? Like, how do you survive? He did somehow.
I will
he
broke say, his like, whole people, fucking leg. People give him a lot of shit about being a coward, but you know what? He did survive, unlike everybody else, and he took that base, so who did the wrong thing there?
Listen, we can't get into like the military politics of it all and whatever, because that's not our lane, but I will say, I'm like, listen, if I would have been there, bitch, I probably would have done the same exact fucking thing. Are you fucking kidding me? Come on now, like, yeah, it takes some cunning for that. But they were like, nah, we can't have you do that again, though. I think General Slauson, I think is his name, that's his boss's name. It makes me think of Tourist Trap too.
Oh god. Do you know how I would die in a horror movie?
How would you die in a horror movie?
I would be on the edge of that cliff, and Robert Carlyle would be coming at me, and I'm like, if you're gonna kill me anyway, can we like fuck beforehand? Like, just
yeah, just like just a little bit. Just like,
I wouldn't just jump off the cliff. I'd be like, oh, I'm gonna die anyway. Like, that's fine. I won't have to worry about bills anymore. But
exactly. Right. Like, there's no rent, there's no groceries, you don't have to eat. Haunting seems kind of cool, so you know, it's all good.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We should probably shout out the squelching effects.
Oh yeah, the squelching effects of just like from that he's licking me to also just like, you know, him trying to put his like fucking broken leg back together.
Any of disgusting. The times people are eating anything.
Oh my god, yeah. Like the beginning of this movie where he's at his base after this whole thing and they all have the meat. That meat looks fucking disgusting, dude.
Yeah. Horrible. Really disgusting.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Yes. Double entendre when he's trying to like prove that Robert Carlyle's bad. He's like, no, I shot him in the arm, and to just like take your shirt off, and he's like slowly disrobing. He's like, surely Major Knox has no desire to hear me cough. And I'm just like, oh my god, just like everybody go fuck. Just go fuck and get it over with. You're all men. You're just stuck here. Just he was his speech I found really seductive. I'm just like, you know, if this was like a real thing, I have really bad depression and stuff. And like I had cancer before. If someone was like, your depression goes away, like sign me up. Like I'll come eat people with you, Robert Carlyle. What's up, Rami Hammer?
Oh God.
A depression cure, like that's an enticing thing.
Sure. I mean, if I just have to eat people
in the 1800s,
yeah,
everyone acts. So I just recently watched Society of the Snow, which is on Netflix. Very, very good Oscar nominated film about the rugby team that crashed in the 70s in the Andes and had to eat each other to survive. Really powerful movie. But everyone acts so like whatever, and it's like if you're in a survival situation and you had the opportunity to eat the food forbidden, you do it. Nobody would judge you.
Well, yeah. And plus, you know, you can. It's interesting how we have this kind of a thing. Like Ravenous was there, like you said, that movie on Netflix. But even just like having Yellow Jackets out there. And that's like gripping as hell, too. I'm just like, whoa, what the fuck?
And we're not getting any more until 2025.
I know. And I'm just like. It took me a while to watch the last episode of the second season, but I finally did. And for those, listen, you just have to go, just get like the cheapest, if you can, get like the cheapest Paramount Plus plan that might include Showtime and just watch it, baby. Just do it. Do yourself a favor if you haven't done it already.
Seriously, it's lonely being a cannibal.
It's lonely being, exactly. And just all the feminine energy of that, just everything amazing. Like five, like I don't know about you, but like I'm not somebody who I love, like I don't like things hyped up because then I'm like, wow, that fucking sucked or whatever, right? Like a part of me is just
Yellow
like
Jacket, you know, blows up to the hype. It's fucking good.
It really does. Like no, and that's what television. I was getting to. No, that's like, what I was getting to, where it was like people are like, is it really that good, da da da. I'm like, no, I think Yellow Jackets is, if you're into that kind of a thing, where you're down for like you know, horror themed like cannibal story with women, like what the like sign me up, like I'm down. There's that. I also think it's very funny, not that it's a cannibal story, but like the chick who plays young Van in it, she's from Santa Clarita Diet, which again is just a zombie story, but like yes, this is very funny.
I also thought that was funny.
But yeah, all of the women in it are iconic. All the girls in it are iconic. This is not about the men at all, which I love. Like Elijah Wood is like one of the strongest men in this movie or in the show, and like
so funny. I would watch an entire series of him and Misty just doing crime together.
I'd love it. Like that one is to me like it does live up to the hype. Whereas something like is Succession as good as people say it is, or like all these kinds of things.
I thought it sounded so boring, and I watched it twice in a year now.
That's
like
fair.
The entire series. It's good.
I'm also the same person who's like, everyone needs to watch 6 Feet Under because I think it also lives up to the hype personally. That's me.
Absolutely. It's a perfect five-season run.
Like literally perfect five seasons. It's on Netflix right now.
Oh, yeah, of all time.
Like literally, this is why I like you, Clayton. Okay, listen.
Thanks.
Like literally you need to watch it. It's amazing. It really does live up to the hype. And also, some people may not like it or not, but I know me and my sister do. Schitt's Creek, I also think lives up to the hype. There's a reason it won a bunch of Emmys, y'all. I'm sorry, but like that show, I don't care what anybody says about it. Blah 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 blah. No, it's worth the hype. It should have won all those Emmys. Like
yeah,
Alexis
I went into
Rose,
that show thinking I was not going to like it. I like went into it like, oh, this is gonna be dumb, and
right,
I fell in love.
Fell in love, and literally, like, I could give a fuck less what David does. Like at some point, because I'm like, okay, that's cute, whatever, whatever. Alexis and her story arc, Fight Me, is the best story arc of that show, period. Don't care. Like it's just so good. Like I just anyway, this is not Schitt's Creek podcast, but I'm just saying, like, oh, believe you me, I would do it, but it's just like, oh, it's so good. Again, love Patrick and David, love that, but like Alexis, oh my God.
Alexis and Moira were my reasons for tuning in.
Absolutely, like 100%. I did not watch that show that she did afterward, unfortunately, but I mean, it's Annie Murphy, like fucking no matter what she's in, like she'll probably be good, so it's all good. Yeah, we didn't really break down any of the characters or anything. We don't think we really need to do that. It's a bunch of men, and they have a whole lot of two of them have a lot of sexual tension. You just want them to fuck, okay?
Yes, all the time.
Basic idea of what this is. And it's kind of interesting because there are that. Yeah, go ahead.
Guy Pearce really rocks a sweater in the final
I thought confrontation. That too.
It's a wonderful blue sweater. He really pulls it off nicely.
He did a great job with that. I was like, that looks so comfy, kind of. And then also, like, he's wearing that. Oh, amazing.
I was just going to, I had one negative. I didn't love some of the editing. I thought the final sequence, which I do forgive a lot because of the situation, and that they had to, like, improv it. I just find it kind of funny, and it drags on, and just kind of like, you know, it is what it is. They were able to pull it together, and some of the editing stuff where it's like, oh, he's like succumbing to the whatever and wanting to eat, and like the flash cuts to Robert Carlyle like putting the cross on his forehead and blood, and just like, it felt very music video and did not tonally fit with the rest of the movie at all. It was very jarring, and I was like, ugh, I'm stoned and I'm thinking about the editing at the climax of this movie. I shouldn't be doing that. So yeah, that was the negative. But otherwise, everything to the final dramatic exhale Robert Carlyle gives that goes on far too long. And I don't know why he did it, but thank you. He didn't have to go that hard and be that extra, but he did that for us.
He did.
Yeah. Great time.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. And I think what the thing with the characters, too, is that like the thing is that a lot of the other characters, there's not that many of them anyway. So like Knox is the alcoholic. Cleaves is the stoner, like you said. So obviously you, him, kid, spirit, it's fine. There's that. I mean, like, really this story to me is very much about Boyd and Calhoun and kind of their whole thing going on, too. Because even Hart's very incidental in this, too. And just, but I think, like, if anything, like, so they are a little, like, some of those other characters are one note in a way, I feel like. But also... Yeah, exactly. But like, I think that those two main characters of Boyd and Calhoun, I really think that they do a really good job. Everyone does a really good job in the movie acting wise. But like, I really do think like they have a lot of substance going on. And really, I guess if anything, like Boyd himself is dealing with, well, was I really a coward? Well, yes. But also like, was I really a coward? And what does that mean? Like, am I just a pussy? Like, really? Like, I don't know. Like, because I'm being punished for it by being sent to this place, right? So, like,
but what do I do now? He kills the Wendigo. He gives his life. And when that's the only way he can kill it. Yeah. And Martha's like, So he was like brave. He saved, you know, countless people in the future. Because they were going to make a little From Dusk Till Dawn army camp.
Like I said, Motel Hell.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I think this, I mean, I guess to wrap up, because we've been talking for almost 2 hours almost just about, but this movie does deserve something of that. I think to close it out, I think this movie is super, I don't think this has not been said before, but like, it's definitely underrated. Is it totally all over the place? A little bit, sure. Is it like a decent little cannibal horror movie with a little bit of a Western flair to it? Yes. And I think it would be worthwhile to give it a watch for sure. I think it's a very unique story. I don't know of another story that's like it that I could just like say, yes, this is that. And I'm always down for those kinds of stories. Like, I'm just like, huh, this feels pretty original and it feels pretty cool. So, you know, I think I love the fact that it does have a cult following of people who like it, who appreciate the queerness, like homosexual undertones in there, all that. But I think overall, like, I'm always okay with a production that maybe was hell to do, but the product, I think, was pretty good. It's just I don't think people knew what to do with it when it came out. That's really it.
Yeah, it's a very wacky experience. It's kind of hard to be like, wait, what is this supposed to be making me feel? I don't know, but I think that's part of its charm.
I think so, too. Yeah. And yeah, if you wanted to read into it of like the stuff about Manifest Destiny and just like colonialism and all this kind of shit, you could dig into that, I'm sure. And I think also just having the inclusion of like at least two Native characters in here, which was cool. The fact that this was also just directed by a woman, I think is really unique too. And I think also just adds to like, yeah, no, you should put this in your rotation of Cannibal Movie Night, you know, if you haven't already. So
it's queer horror. Like, gotta,
it is queer horror. Yeah, it's very, it is queer horror for sure. So definitely watch it in June if you can, you know, for sure. Do you know where the streams ever are like that? I know it's streamed on Criterion Channel before. Think, where else? Maybe.
I don't know. I own this personally. So
who released it?
Yeah. I don't know. I have it digitally, actually. You know, I said I was an addict earlier. I had a huge library and sold it all for drugs. Don't do heroin, people.
Please don't.
My library is just digital. It's quite large, but yeah, so I purchased on that. I don't know who put it out, but I think there's at least a Blu-ray of it.
I think there is, or something like that. But if anything, I think renting would be good too. Yeah,
definitely. Like, it's worth it. I would say buy it, but it's definitely worth a rent. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be mad about spending that money.
Right, I agree. Also, if you have a VPN, just go into UK or Canada and go on Disney Plus and watch it. Which is what I did. So you could do that too. But yeah, I think that's everything I can think though. But Clayton, I want to thank you so much for coming on my show. I really liked our conversation and you seem like a cool dude, cool movie gay, which I appreciate.
But I like it.
Well, and also just talking about like your own experience and like, you know, that you yourself are somebody in recovery and you can kind of see that with like, the characters in this, like, you know, I always appreciate people being vulnerable on my show too, all that kind of shit. But yeah, don't do drugs, kids, please.
Yeah. make good choices.
But yeah,
Shout Factory put out a Blu-ray in 2015.
Oh, awesome. All right, I'm gonna have to look, because okay, so the goal this year is not that I have like a ton of goals, but like with movie collection stuff, Criterion sale, I'm gonna get Trainspotting probably because they released it. But I want to wait for the sale. And then I guess also I'm going to go see if I can find some Scream Factory Blu-rays and see where I can find those at. I might put Ravenous on there. So we'll see. But yeah, going to probably do that because why not? But again, thank you so much for coming on the show. I guess if you want to plug your socials, tell me a little bit about your show, the Men Who Like Movies podcast.
Yeah. I will talk about myself. I'm Clayton, have the Men Who Like Movies podcast with my co-host Sean, and we'll go back and forth and each pick a film we think deserves to be talked about. And we have a bunch of really fun guests, critics, people that work in the industry, just love movies and super queer, good time. You can find it anywhere. Men Who Like Movies. You can find the podcast on the socials. It's at MMPod with 3 M's. You can find me on the socials and on Letterboxd at Just Happy to See You, letter U. I think that's pretty much everything.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's pretty much all. I'll have to listen to some more of the show, I guess, and, you know, just try to see. But this will not be your first time on this is your first time on the show, but it won't be your last, I'm sure. I have some other titles that I want to have you and the co-host on for.
Absolutely.
Why the hell not? And then I'm sure I'll also find something to cover on your show, but that won't be until probably next year, everybody, which is fine.
I schedule really far in advance, everyone. I'm sorry. I need the structure.
Yeah, but and what's cool too about your show that I noticed is that, similar to how I like to do it, I didn't want to just have a horror show, even though I love horror. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have something that was also, obviously I tend to cover cult film, but the definition of cult film can be changing every so often. So it's this thing of, I have covered stuff that maybe aren't cult movies, quote unquote, depending on your definition. But I will say that I like that I'm able to not just focus on horror, but I can focus on comedy, musicals, things like that. So
absolutely. There were definitely a lot of talks that went into that because, like, you know, you do better if the more you know, it's like being a doctor. The more specialized you are, the better things go. But I'm like, I love horror, but I wouldn't want to be constricted to just horror. What if I wanted to talk about Mamma Mia or something? Like, yeah. So yeah, all kinds of content. There's stuff there for everyone, literally all kinds of movies.
Love that. Yeah. Well, again, thank you so much for coming on the show. And it won't be your last time, of course, but I hope you enjoy the rest of your evening. And thank you so much. And we'll sign off now. All right.
Bye.
Bye. If you'd like to get in touch with me, you can do so at cultcinemacircle@gmail.com. If you'd like to give movie recommendations, give feedback on the show, be a guest, whatever, I'm open to all of it. And on social media, you can follow the show. On Instagram, I'm at cultcinemacircle. And on Twitter, I'm at cultcinecircle. You can also follow follow me on Letterboxd at Jesse, J-E-S-S-E, Kremp, K-R-E-M-P, all one word. On the social media platforms, I'll post what the next episode is. I interact with people, post stories, post little movie reviews of things I've been watching, all that kind of fun stuff. If you haven't already done so, please give 5 stars and a 1 to 2 sentence review on your podcatcher of choice, whether that be Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audible, YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts. Please, you know, the engagement helps get eyes on the show, get more listeners to the show, and keeps me doing this thing that I love to do, which is covering these different cult movies. For next week's episode, we're going to be covering a little movie from 1989, and that is called Troop Beverly Hills. If you don't know what Troop Beverly Hills is about, it's about a mother in Beverly Hills who's going through a divorce, and she's trying to find some direction in her life, and she decides she's going to lead her daughter's wilderness group that is set in Beverly Hills. Shelley Long movie, super fun. So it's a first time watch for me, so I'll be happy to cover it. And that's what we're doing next week. But as always, thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the Cult Cinema Circle podcast. And remember, it's not courage to resist me, Boyd. It's courage to accept me. Take care. Bye.